Coming up on this week's show, a legendary gaming company is back for 2025.
Why your Super Nintendo might be getting faster.
And we go inside the world of Elder Scrolls with Vijay Lakshman.
The Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our sponsor, our friends at Bitmap Books. Now, if you enjoyed this week's interview, if you're a big fan of the RPGs, have you seen their book, A Guide to Japanese Role-Playing Games? Now, this covers one of the biggest genres around the world, from games like Dragon's Quest to Final Fantasy. Pokemon games are in here as well. Japanese Guide to Role-Playing Games covers the expansive history of JRPGs, starting on 8-bit micros and following them all the way up to the heavy hitters of the modern era, and weighing in at a massive 652 pages, their biggest book to date. You can check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay. Now, I'm sure you know about PCBWay. If you're in the market for a fully featured custom PCB prototyping service, they have got you covered. And you know they've got their legendary low-cost, fast turnaround quality board service. And they do services like 3D printing and injection molding. And check out the shared project section of their website. Have a look at all the stuff they're doing in the retro community right now. Again, instant quote for yours at PCBWay.com. And welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 471, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for the podcast that every single Friday brings you up to speed on what's been happening in the wonderful wide world of retro gaming and technology, and welcomes on veterans of the industry for a bit of a chat about their career and the games and the companies that they work for in the second half of the podcast. And we've got an amazing guest on the way in the second half of the show. As always, we'll tell you more about that in just a bit. But before we do that, we thought now that the weather is getting... Well, it was getting slightly warmer at the weekend. I think we're back down to like minus one or something again tonight in the UK. But the warmer months are on the way, and that means more events are coming up. So the start of the events calendar for 2025. Quite a bit coming up, actually, for us over the next few months.
Yeah, there's quite a lot going on around the world this year in retro, actually. It's really interesting to see. Locally, we've got NQ64 opening up in our city. And I know it's a great kind of arcade bar. Lots of people have seen it, and we're going to pop along to the launch as well. I'm really excited, actually, because, I get to play some Time Crisis and a bit of House of the Dead in my home city.
That's in Nottingham in the UK. So that's going to be, when's that open? End of the month?
Yeah.
And Joe's got something coming up in April?
Yeah, I'm going to be at the Nottingham Video Games Market, which is going to be at the Harvey Haddon Centre on the 6th of April. So I'll be there. I'll be slinging some Super Nintendos and some Segas with my mate Jason. I love how Ravi said, like, there's lots of retro going around in the world, but we're staying in Nottingham.
Yeah, two events in Nottingham. Well, I'm going to go a bit further afield, lads, because I'm actually planning a trip over to America to go to an event called VCF East. That's going to be Jersey. Yeah, I was going to say you went, like, what, 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, it's great. Vintage Computer Festival. And New Jersey, you're going to love it, Dan, on the Broadwalk. I'm sure you'll really enjoy it.
Well, the missus is coming with me as well, so we're going to do, like, a bit of time in New York as well. To me, looking at the lineup of VCF East is getting me salivating, seeing these incredible talks and all the hardware. Didn't do quite the same for my missus, so I had to kind of tie in a bit of family time as well. But I mean,
shopping for Sam.
There'll be a fair bit of that.
Love,
I'm sure,
to go into New York and probably the Disney store. You'll be hitting up, no doubt.
My wallet is going to get hammering when I'm out there, I'm sure. But I mean, really, the big draw for me at VCF East, I mean, for people that haven't been to that event before, it's like a 3-day event, isn't it? Like an entire weekend, and starts on Friday, April the 4th. And I mean, kind of explain from your perspective what kind of happens at VCF East then.
Well, we go to retro events in like Europe and look around those. They're very kind of multi-system. VCF is computers. It is all very computer focused. You'll hardly have any console stuff there. And it's interesting because it's a very different type of computer as well. There's lots of IBMs over there. There's lots of Macs. They had this great kind of trading room where people just came and like dumped massive, huge systems in there and, all kinds of obscurities, manuals and stuff. And it was, I think it was on like a military base as well. So they had like a radio towers. Like when I came in, there was a big general with a cigar like leading traffic, you know, like from one of the old American movies. And yeah, it's really cool because they have some really interesting talks and they have really interesting guests around the whole kind of world of computing. And this year, you know, it's a celebration of Amiga's 40th birthday. So I'm sure that's been a draw for you, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the main reason that I'm going out there. But you did mention how computer focused it is. I mean, I'm looking at the panels they're going to be doing. One of them is an hour long history of Unix.
Exactly. Yeah, this is ultimate like computer show, you know.
Bart van der Acker, our mate, is going to be out there. He's going to be doing a talk about restoring a CAD machine. So he's coming over from the Home Computer Museum. But yeah, there is a big Amiga 40 panel that runs on the Saturday from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., like a 2-hour panel. RJ Michael, Dale Luck, Ron Nicholson, Glenn Keller, Andy Finkel, Jeff Porter, Gail Wellington. Anyone that knows about the Amiga, I'm sure those names are like legendary. I think we've only had out of that list. We've actually had RJ on the podcast, haven't we? So definitely going to be taking a little Zoom recorder with me and hopefully bagging a few interviews and fingers crossed recording that panel so we can play it out on the podcast.
Yeah, it would be fantastic. And, you know, there's so many Amiga events going on at the moment in this year in the world. You know, I think they're doing a huge one in Silicon Valley. We're also going to Amiga Germany as well.
In October.
We're going over to there in October. There's Cambridge Computer Museum are doing an Amiga thing as well.
I'd
previously done an Amiga event for the past 2 years as well. Mm. And this year we decided to go small scale just because the audience is so spread absolutely everywhere and everyone's going to be fighting for guests. So I decided, you know, in the kind of slow, quiet periods, that's when we'd be there for you with Kickstart. So Kickstart's going to be like a kind of birthday party music event that we're going to do after all the big events have kind of happened. You know, just as we're approaching winter, we're going to have a music night, get some Amiga musicians, you know, some world famous ones there as well. Celebrate the Amiga in the UK, have a little bash. But then next year, we're going to be coming back with a big show, you know, 800 people, huge like it was before. And, you know, Amiga shows in the UK, some of them only went on for 2 years and then they completely collapsed. Like, I want to continue it longer than that. You know, I want it to be sustainable. So, anybody that's been asking about it, keep an eye for the gig that's going to be coming up just after summer.
And one Amiga nerd, shout out to Dan, who messaged me on Facebook the other day asking about it. He said, you've got to get up to at least Kickstart 3.0. Because, you know, Amiga fans you can't stop it.
It will be 3.0 and then the next one will be 3.1.
Nice. There you go. So, yeah, plenty of stuff going on.
3.2.4.5 or whatever.
Those Amiga operating systems have some obscure numbers. But, yeah, so we're looking forward to another exciting summer of events. We'll start in later on this month. So if you're going to be at any of those, come along and say hi. So I did mention that we have a big guest on the podcast this week. And anyone that's a fan of games like Elder Scrolls or Crash Bandicoot and Spyro the Dragon, you're going to love this week's guest.
Yes. So this is Vijay Luxham. And Vijay's absolutely amazing because he's a co-creator of Elder Scrolls. So he was in Bethesda Softworks when it was the really early days. And it's very interesting because they were also developing lots of other titles at the time. Terminator 2090 as well, which was like a Terminator RPG, very interestingly. There were titles coming out for the Amiga as well, and lots of, you know, multi-systems, PC and Mac. And of course, Elder Scrolls Arena, which was one of the first undertakings. And Vijay is a really interesting character because he's co-designed it, but he wrote so much. He said he wrote like 4 or 5 novels worth of storyline before they broke it down to what it actually became. And of course, you know, with Ted Peterson working on there as well, it was an absolutely amazing title. Elder Scrolls is still going on today and absolutely huge. But then he moved on to do some other stuff as well. So, you know, Crash Bandicoot is quite a big name out there. He did Crash Bash. He was a producer on there. And also the famous Spyro the Dragon.
That's quite a varied game library he worked on there. It's like Elder Scrolls to Crash Bandicoot,
And I think the whole thing that kind of runs through his work is also RPGs as well. So Lord of the Rings Online as well. And then, Dungeons & Dragons later on. And he's a novel writer now. It's a really interesting interview because it is so varied and so many different companies there as well, with like Warner Brothers and Turbine Entertainment and all those movie licenses that they got.
You mentioned about D&D because I mean, like many of the
the people in the industry from that time. He started with Dungeons and Dragons. That was a main thing that kind of...
We've had so many guests. That
Trip Hawkins was the same, wasn't he? More British.
D&D as their start, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was a foundation of so many people who later went to work in the video games industry. And that kind of thread goes through a lot of his career, doesn't it? And actually, he got to work on a D&D game as well in the mid-2000s.
When Elder Scrolls came out, you know, there were so many rivals at the time. You know, so it's really interesting to hear about it in that kind of context.
Yeah, so really enjoyed this week's interview. By the way, we do a video version of the interviews as well for our patrons, which...
Yeah, a video version of this one. And we've done, what is it, 3 video versions now? So, yeah, we're getting used to it.
What did we call it last week? A public beta? So if you want to join, we try and figure out video for the podcast. If you'd like to check it out, available to all our patrons, you can join at theretrohour.com. Now, first half of the podcast, that's when we have a little chat about what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last week or so. And this story actually dates back a few weeks when there was an update to Call of Duty Black Ops 6. Now, there was a bit of DLC that came out on... COD, I must admit, you know, you guys know that I was quite a big COD player. Kind of gone off it a bit last couple of releases. I mean, it was on Game Pass, wasn't it, the latest one? I think I played it launch weekend. Haven't touched it since. Don't know about you, Joe.
I've played one game of Zombies.
Yeah.
On it, on my own, my dad as well. And that's the first time I've played COD since 2020.
Yeah. I mean, I used to get it annually, and it was like, it's quite sad because I look at when I'm on Xbox Live, like, I've still got people on there that I used to play COD with all the time who, like, haven't been online for, like, 6 years or something next to the name. It's a bit, you know, and you see it like, I remember those days. Playing Modern Warfare 2. But for those that are still playing COD, in Black Ops 6 Season 2, there is a map on there called Grind, which is a skate park map. And in the new version of that, some people spotted that there was an addition to it, which was a large TV screen up on the wall with a font that looks very familiar to fans of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, a logo that looks quite like it, and it said March the 4th, 2025 on it. So that got a lot of people talking a couple of weeks ago. Does that mean that we're getting some more Tony Hawk's games? And it turns out this week it has been announced. It's coming in July.
Yeah, so we're getting Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3 and 4 remake on July 11th. Do you remember, like, the clutch that Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 and 2 remake had on, like, millennials? What, about 3-4 years ago when that came out?
I was one of the millennials.
Same, but, like, everybody I spoke to, even, like, my barber, who he's a bit of a PC gamer. Funny enough, he plays the Elder Scroll games, but, like, he was obsessed with Pro Skater, like, 1 and 2, the remaster, remake, whatever you want to call it. But I don't know if 3 and 4 is going to have the same impact.
Yeah, so I got the remasters 1 and 2, and I must say they were absolutely fantastic. Like, out of the remasters that I've played, Jesus, they were good. Like, improved graphics, but still had the gameplay and, of course...
The feel of it.
Yeah, those recognisable levels, but... Really, for me, Tony Hawk's 2 dominated so much.
Mm.
It kind of like, later on, I got into Underground when that series came out. You know, 3 and 4 kind of passed me by a bit. But everyone I've talked to who's played it has said 4 is like peak, is one of the best, you know.
Yeah, you see, for me, I played 2 and 3 the most.
Okay.
And a lot of people always talk about how iconic Tony Hawk's Pro Skater's soundtrack was.
Ooh.
Obviously, the CKY song, what's it called? 96 Bit of Springs, is it called?
Bit of Beings, yeah.
Bit of Beings, yeah. The
96 Quiet Bit of Beings.
That's it, yeah. That's actually on Pro Skater 3. I always thought it was on Pro Skater 2. So that's the most famous thing I can remember about Pro Skater 3.
That's an interesting point that you put up, because there's some new tracks in there. So of course, with licensing, you know, there's big issues with getting certain tracks back on there. Of course, it's got the classic ones. You know, you've got KRS-One in there, Motorhead, Ace of Spades, you know, it's got some new ones as well. Kendrick Lamar's in there. There's some interesting additions, and I think some of the new features are quite cool as well, where like the cross-platform multiplayer is really cool.
And as well as it being cross-platform on multiplayer, it's up to 8 skaters at once on one map, which just sounds like absolute chaos.
Yeah.
Which I think, I don't know if I'm looking forward to that or not. I think I'll pick this up, but I don't know about you, Ravi, but when I replayed the 1 and 2 remaster, I forgot how hard they were. Like, I got towards, like, I think I got to like the second to last level in the game on like the campaign, and I was like, damn, this is so difficult to progress. Like, the game was so tough. So I don't know if I'll fare any better with this one.
Yeah, I kind of got used to it again though, like, but then I didn't play it on a console. So I played it on the PC with quite, like, I had quite a good graphics card and stuff, so I ramped it all up then. And then I was streaming it on the Steam Link and had a controller, like an Xbox One. And it was okay, but to be honest, Tony Hawk, I always need to play it with a PlayStation controller, even though I never had, like, a later PlayStation. It just needs to be done on a DualShock, you know?
It's interesting you mention that because, you know, often when they do these remakes or remasters, they often do kind of put some, like, modern quality of life improvements in there to make the controls a bit easier. So they didn't do that with the last one then?
No, it was just the challenge of doing the tricks. It's a solid game, but also, you know, I think for completionists, there's a lot more things you can do, a lot more things you can unlock as well. And people know those levels like the absolute back of their hand. It's very interesting to see that they've got a kind of collector's edition that has a whole skate deck.
Signed by Tony Hawk's.
Yeah, custom Tony Hawk skate deck. To be honest, there's probably millions of custom Tony Hawk skate decks around the world. But it comes with extra content as well. And it's Birdhouse, which is, you know, the kind of brand that Tony Hawk's associated with being the Birdman.
And they're going to be putting it out on physical, which is good to see. So now a lot of games are kind of going down the digital only route recently.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get this because I was such a 1 and 2 fan that they're like new games to me. You know, yeah. I've hardly played them, and then playing them in this new way is going to be great.
Have you guys seen, obviously in the original Tony Hawk games, famously they had a lot of hidden characters like Spider-Man and Wolverine and Darth Maul. Have you seen the hidden characters in this that they've already announced? It's Doomslayer. From the modern Doom games. And the, is it called the Revenant? Like one of the skeleton characters, enemies, which I thought was quite funny. I can't remember if there was a hidden character in the 1 and 2 remake, but yeah, I thought that was quite funny that they put Doomslayer.
I remember the Jackass guys and CKY guys in Tony Hawk's Underground 2, I think it was.
Yeah. It was actually 3 and 4, where like Bam Margera and all of them.
Oh, they're in that as well. Yeah.
They were in 3 and 4, if I remember rightly. But I did see an article, I didn't read into it, but he isn't in these remakes, which doesn't surprise me with everything that's been going on with him over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Or it could just be a licensing thing. Who knows?
Like with the music, you know, yeah, it could be some licensing.
I think great to see it back. I mean, you guys were way more into it than I was. And I think my brother had like the demo on his PlayStation we used to play.
We used to go out skating and then we'd play skating afterwards.
But I think, I mean, looking at the trailer, the graphics are gorgeous. I mean, you know, being able to play these games, just the fact that you can play them in 4K, I think looks absolutely stunning. And pre-orders are open now. And actually, so I mean, I'm often a bit kind of like, why would you ever like pre-order a digital game? I get that it downloads to your console and like launch, then you've got it waiting for you. But also if you do pre-order the digital deluxe edition, you also get access to a demo in June as well, so you can get
and also one quick thing about Tony Hawk's as well, most of the levels, I think maybe 90% of them, are based on real world locations, which is really cool. So you are kind of going back and visiting that point at that kind of certain part of town, because a lot of them have kind of been shut down or closed off and, you know, you can't use them anymore, but a lot of the spots in the game are actually real ones, and some are actually like bonkers places that don't exist at all, but you know.
Yeah, so I think, going to be very popular. So I expect this to sell very well. Pre-orders, like I said, are open right now. Comes out in July. So if you want to check out the trailer, I'll link that in this week's show notes. Now, other big news, I did see a rather big update coming out from a previous guest on this podcast. That's Enrique from the Spectrum Next team. Now, he did like a massive update on their Kickstarter page a couple of weeks ago, or last week, talking about basically all the stuff that's been happening over the last few months, the start of 2025 on the Spectrum Next platform. Now, just kind of looking at, kind of skim reading some of this. This looks mad. There's actually a thing called SymbOS that has been ported to the Spectrum Next,
I knew the most interesting thing straight away would be the operating system for you, Dan.
Are you looking at a screenshot of this or a video? I mean, it looks amazing. Do you not think the look of that just looks incredible?
Yeah, I think that's great to see. Yeah, it looks a bit too Windows-y for me, but that's probably the icon style and the start menu that every OS kind of had. But this is from like Amstrad CPC, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it started in, 2006. It's on the MSX. Amstrad CPC's got a version of it as well. It's running on the Spectrum Next now as well. Fully multitasking windowed operating system, which I think is very cool. They've got a video of that demonstrated. A bunch of new games that have come out over the last few months as well. Some of them on physical that it kind of goes into. One thing I really like the look of as well is if you haven't tried this out, there is a really good Spectrum Next emulator by our friend Mike Daly, yes, called C-Spect. So if you haven't got the hardware, then this is available to run not only on your PC, but also the latest version, 3.0.1.0, now runs full speed on the Raspberry Pi 500. The Pi 500 is like, it's the latest version of the 400, the all-in-one keyboard unit that kind of looks a bit like a retro kind of Spectrum. So I think having that running full speed on there for free, if you want to get involved in the Spectrum Next scene, really good way of doing it. But the big news is, and this is the one that he kind of saved the big headline to the end of this article, said they didn't want to take away from all the amazing work the community's doing, but they are doing a third Kickstarter for the Spectrum Next.
Which is nice because, there's all these clones out there, but of course having the Next with that iconic design.
Yeah.
And, everything that we've talked about with it, like the high quality of it. You've got one yourself, Dan. I'm sure you absolutely love it.
It's a beautiful machine, I think. It's weird though, because sometimes I feel almost like like it's a bit of a museum piece because it's so gorgeous. I just want to keep it protected in the box rather than having it set up and exposed to the elements and the dust.
You nerd.
Yeah, which sounds really wrong.
In a chamber.
Yeah, because the packaging's gorgeous as well. And I like the experience of opening the box and seeing the keyboard all mint and pristine. So beautiful bit of kit. And obviously the last Kickstarter they did in 2020, it earned £1.8 million. So it was an absolute smash, one of the biggest retro computing Kickstarters ever. So, I mean, there have been a lot of people. It's been 5 years since the last Kickstarter. So they say they are basically planning the third one. Because, I mean, a lot of them have been popping up on eBay and, people have been asking for like £700-800 for them. And a lot of people have got the second Kickstarter that then either, I get it because it's 5 years ago and it was quite heavily delayed because of COVID. Some people either just kind of lost interest or decided that they could double their money by selling them on eBay. So I think there's definitely demand for it. So I think really exciting to see that they're going to be doing a third installment of the Kickstarter and getting them into more people's hands. So we will keep an eye on that story. And if you want to read that big update, I'll link that in the show notes as well. Now, this story is really weird. I've seen this in a few places, and actually this is quite well-timed because I was chatting on our Discord the other day. You guys know that I've got like an area of my house which is meant to be my work room where I, record the podcast and I do my day job in here as well. Definitely not a second gaming room. I told the missus when I got this room built, looking around me, I've got an Amiga 1200 next to me. I've now got a Mega Drive and a Mega CD set up, my Atari Jaguar, PlayStation 4's in here, Philips CDI, and my Super Nintendo, which I set up at the weekend as well, hooked up to a lovely CRT with a SCART switcher. So I'd say, maybe 51% of this room still dedicated to work.
Slowly gathering around you machines and, distractions as well.
Yes. So, one thing I didn't notice, because I had a bit of a blast of the SNES the other night. I played a bit of Another World, actually, at the weekend on the Super Nintendo. I didn't realise it was running any quicker than it used to, though, because this headline, I've seen this in quite a few places, including the Metro, which is like a kind of a newspaper. I think it's still a physical paper, isn't it, the Metro? always get it on a train normally or a bus.
Yeah, it's still around.
Well, they did a headline the other day saying the Super Nintendo console is running faster as it gets older and nobody can figure out why.
I've seen this floating about for like a week everywhere, and it comes from a Blue Sky thread from something called TASBot or TASBot, which is a tool for speed running. So I'm assuming it's the group behind TASBot who are, you know, been, what you call it? I'm guessing you don't call it tweeting on Blue Sky. What do you call it? Blueing?
I don't know.
Oh, God, there was an awful term for it. Yeah, I can't remember it, but...
Posting on Blue Sky.
Skeets, that's what they're called. You're skeeting on Blue
Skeeting.
Sky.
Skeeting. Okay.
Right.
Weird phrase.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you said, Joe, this is a team on there who basically have been doing some benchmarks. And they've noticed something rather peculiar, that the Super Nintendo's DSP actually gets faster when the chip gets warm. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here about, you know, hertz and that kind of stuff and numbers that we won't go into. But, weirdly, it turns out that it's the audio. So the audio chip on the Super Nintendo is actually speeding up as these systems get older.
So this article, when I first saw it, I thought like, oh, CPU, that's going to be weird if that speeds up as it's getting hotter. Mm. Because as we know, you know, like cooler CPUs, everyone's trying to get those. But audio kind of makes a bit of sense to me. So in the days of pirate radio and playing around with that stuff, the weather would massively affect where a kind of transmitter was on a frequency. So if it was colder, sometimes it can move down. Sometimes it would move up. And audio seems to be something that's, especially with, like, I know it's digital, but kind of digital analog stuff, is something that's a bit, like, fluid, especially when components get a bit old and, you know, there's certain changes with them. Now, I think there's this ridiculous part of this story which says people are kind of, speedrunners are running the machines on hot plates to get the DSP kind of going. But how would that help if it's just the sound? I don't understand.
Well, apparently there was another glitch that was discovered a few years ago. This is by basically people at speedrun Dragon's Quest 3. And they noticed that there is basically a glitch in the game that allows you to complete it quicker that only appears when the Super Nintendo is around 80 degrees Celsius. So... the only way they can get that glitch to appear is by heating up the SNES. That's why they've been putting it on a hot plate. So,
and that's so weird because everybody we've talked to, you know, even when we had id Software on the podcast and they talked about, you know, Doom and putting the, what was it? The Jaguar.
The Atari Jaguar.
In the fridge.
Yeah,
to cool it down because, you know, that was getting too hot. But these guys seem to be going the opposite way. And heating it up. And they're probably like, you know, creating more problems and they're
killing the hardware
quicker. Yeah, definitely. Sure.
But it's interesting though. I mean, yeah, I think it is probably related to what you said. I imagine it's just aging components that maybe it's some fluctuation in voltages. Maybe, you know, the voltage regulators are not working quite as well as they were.
And kind of the only example I can think of someone heating something up was when people got the red ring of death and they were trying to like reflow the solder or kind of get that fixed by wrapping an Xbox in a towel or putting it in the oven. That was an old move.
Yeah, I mean, it is. There's a lot of people talking about this and giving their theories on it. I think it is quite interesting. I mean, yeah, you're not going to be putting like your Mario cartridge into it and suddenly it's a double speed or anything like that. It's very subtle, but it looks like you know, they're basically, these benchmarks show that the Super Nintendo's APU is running faster in 2025 than it did when it was released back in the 90s. So quite an interesting curiosity, but I think some people have also said that it could mean that these systems are kind of getting towards the end of their life, maybe, you know, edging closer to death.
That's not meant to last that long can start to do weird things.
They'd be amazed if anyone used them in 5 years, never mind 35 years. So interesting. If you want to read more about that, I'll link that in the show notes. The quirks of this hardware as it gets older. Now, this was quite exciting to see. if you remember the logo before games like Turok back in the day and South Park and Shadow Man and Burnout. And I remember seeing it in front of, so many games on my Amiga as well back then. You remember the Acclaim logo, Acclaim Software, that kind of very angular font with the kind of rainbow jagged line underneath it as well. That kind of turning up at the start of a game was always an exciting moment. And Acclaim Software, I mean, they haven't been around for a couple of years. They vanished more than two decades ago. But the big news is almost a similar kind of story to what we covered with Argonaut Software at the start of the year. Alex Joseph has actually brought back the Acclaim name. They're back in business and apparently going to be rekindling some of their classic titles and working with indie studios.
I don't have many of my retro games out anymore since having my daughter. They're all stored up in the attic and stuff. But I do have my Sega Mega Drive and Sega Saturn collection in my office, if you will. And I turn around and have a look at it. And it is actually incredible how many of these games have actually got the Acclaim logo on the side of them.
Mm.
Like the Mortal Kombat games, which nobody seems to have mentioned in any of these articles, actually.
That was what I was thinking of on the Amiga, actually. I was like, what game did I used to? Because I remember that appearing on Mortal Kombat 2 at the start. Yeah.
So they did Turok always comes to my mind because I remember the intro at the start of the game and seeing the Acclaim logo. But it's cool. Not only, obviously, are they back, but it is cool to see that they've come back and they're coming back as, you know, a developer as well. They're not just like, oh, yeah, we're back, and it's like a Mickey Mouse, you know, somebody's bought them, you know, another company's bought them, and they're just using it as a way to get around developing more games for the Nintendo Switch or whatever. It genuinely looks like they're back and, you know, they're going to be working. They've not announced any games or anything like that yet, but the CEO has said that, you know, there's a really talented team with him. And they are here to be, you know, launching new games. And, you know, I don't know if that's going to be brand new games or if it's going to be remasters, remakes, etc. Either way, I'm here for it. Like, I'm happy to see it.
Yeah, I mean, thinking of the games they released as well, I mean, I'm looking through some of the titles. I mean, the NBA Jam games, you know, the home ports of those on the consoles.
Constructor for me as well, which was like System 3 release. That was one of my favourite, you know, kind of old school ones. But also, yeah, there were a lot of titles. Revolt, if you remember that.
Yeah. In the WWF and WWE wrestling games as well.
Yeah.
Which were massive back in the day.
Extreme G as well.
Yes. So, I mean, there's plenty they could bring back. I mean, obviously, I'm not really sure kind of how, because often when companies go under, they went bankrupt in 2004. And then I'm not really sure kind of what happens to, you know, I imagine there's quite a few other companies that kind of took parts of the company away, you know, kind of people almost like vultures come along and cherry pick at the IPs and stuff as well. So whether they managed to get like the rights to all of that back again, I'm not sure. But I think if they can bring some of those classic franchises back, then that will be incredible. I think just even seeing the Acclaim logo at the start of a game on your Switch is going to bring back like so much nostalgia, isn't it? So very exciting to see them back. And I think it just, you know, the fact that in 2025, we've already got Argonaut and Acclaim back again, just seems like a really exciting time for these industry veterans to make a return. So looking forward to seeing what they're doing. And obviously when the time is right, I think it will be nice if we reach out to these guys and maybe find out what they're doing when they're up and running properly again. So we look forward to seeing more from Acclaim in coming months. Now, this is a headline that shocked quite a few people. I noticed on my social media timelines over the last week or so that don't make you feel too old, lads, but you know that we are now two decades away from the launch of the legendary Sony PlayStation 3.
That is insane, honestly. Like, I still think of it as like a modern console that like, I haven't touched that yet. I can't afford one.
It's weird though, because I've got a PS3 original, the fat, as I believe they call it. Just feels to like a premium bit of hardware. That kind of nice glossy case and those kind of touch sensitive buttons and having a Blu-ray drive in there as well.
Does it feel a bit wrong to be talking about it at the retro hour? Even though it's two decades, it's like, yeah, it's a weird, weird thing. Yeah,
got time. It does. But I mean, in terms of, you know, the tech industry, 20 years is a hell of a long time. You know, you think when the PS3 was launched 20 years before that was still, you know, the Commodore 64 and the Spectrum was still new. So that kind of puts it into perspective. Well, the big news is that this week, it's not too exciting when you drill into it, but I think the fact that this has happened has surprised quite a few people, that Sony pushed out an update for the PlayStation 3 last week.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. Loads of people are talking about this. And like, oh my God, there's been an update for the PS3. And straight away I was like, didn't they shut all the marketplace and everything down for the PS3? Like, what's going on? And then when you read what it's for, it is very, very boring. but it's I think it's more just an oddity to see that Sony even thought of this. But in the same respect, like, I can also see why they thought of it. So it's an update for the Blu-ray player for an encryption key. It's like,
which has a really interesting story, actually. I know you guys really? Said it's boring, but
so
when HD DVD came out and Blu-ray, there was a famous cracker called Arnie Zami, and basically he broke the processing key, which was like the way to decrypt Blu-ray.
Was that the one that was on dig.com?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much straight away.
Which, like, is coming back,
but and he did HD DVD, so you know it came out as like this great massive. Oh, no one's going to be able to pirate it, you know. And then straight away, this guy just broke it. And then once it was broke, it was cracked again and again and again and again. And I think part of this is, you know, they still don't want Blu-rays to be pirated and put on it. And Sony has a stake in Blu-ray, obviously, because it was like developed through the Blu-ray BD consortium with Sony on board. So this update is probably because they're trying to like protect that really small market of people that are playing, like, you know, cracked
pirated Blu-ray,
copied pirated Blu-rays on their PS3s, and they're still bothered about that.
That's weird. Know,
maybe they're like really, you know, a bit burned or butthurt after it got cracked so early on.
You know what? It's funny because I was talking to a mate of mine. He was downloading some movies from probably somewhere he shouldn't, and he said to me, he goes, do you need a VPN to do that anymore? Do they not care now? And I was like, I've not heard of anyone getting an ISP letter for a while.
Do you know, streaming is making so much money through movies nowadays that kind of movie piracy is a very small thing, I think. But obviously Sony still care.
So this is update 4.9.2, which is out right now. Anything else to it, Joe, then, or is that about it?
That's it, really. That is literally it. It's, you know, an encryption key. I thought it would, there's me thinking, oh, Sony think like, oh, you know, people are still using the PS3. Some people are still using it as a Blu-ray player in bedrooms and stuff, so we better update it. And then Ravi's like, nah, it's just to make sure people aren't pirating.
And I think, like, if they really cared about the Blu-ray, they'd lock off the homebrew stuff. If they really cared about, you know, games.
Well,
selling on it and stuff.
That is something that I did see. And I was reading a thread on Reddit about this the other day, and they said now it means the current jailbreaks don't work.
Which
I'm sure they will find a way around that.
There'll be some kind of mod to get through it and some kind of exploit. But, you know, turning that off as well also makes me think then if they have done that, you know, maybe they do care a bit about games. Who knows? Like, it does seem to be Blu-ray, though, as a primary.
Well, yeah,
I guess that can apply to games as well. Then.
I've got a feeling the fact that it kind of cancels out the jailbreak or that doesn't work is just because it's a new version, so they haven't jailbroken it yet. It's just the fact that you're updating it.
And they'll probably break Blu-ray if anyone could be bothered. You know, it's
I think just the novelty though of turning on your PS3 and seeing an update on the in 2025.
Not another update.
Yeah. The last one was about a year ago. So they did do one in 2024 as well, apparently, for a similar reason. Although apparently that was to improve system performance. No further details. So there you go. Sony are still, you know, in some way supporting the PS3, though, which is cool to see. So if you want to read more about that, I'll put that. And of course, all the rest of the stories, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week by putting them in the show notes on your podcast app, or you can click straight through to the links on our website, theretrohour.com. Also the same place if you want to join our wonderful patrons community as well. Which, you know, we did mention we do a hangout every month for the patrons.
Which is really good fun. It's great to chat to everyone on there. And also we occasionally get a patron on the show as well, which is good. Sometimes getting them to guest and actually appear on the show. And we also have, you know, some extra bonuses, which is like an ad-free episode. We also have the After Hours podcast and the RSS feed. So what you can do is, if you're a patron, you can sign up and you can get all of these ad-free apps and also all the After Hours podcasts just in one huge RSS feed and have it straight on your podcast player.
Yeah, we do an extra like 10, 15 minutes of news stories in every episode as well, just for the patrons. A few of those coming up for you in a second if you are on the Patreon. So a really good time to join us and support the podcast. Keep the lights on, make sure we can keep going throughout the rest of 2025. And of course, if you'd like to join our public beta and check out the video versions of the podcast, which we're hoping to put out to everyone eventually. But right now, we know we're loving the feedback that we're getting from our patrons. So all the details to sign up are on the website, theretrohour.com. All right, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. More for you on next Friday's podcast, and next going inside the world of Elder Scrolls, Bethesda Softworks, Crash Bash Spyro the Dragon, and lots more as well with our special guest, Vijay Lakshman. He's on the way next on the Retro Hour podcast.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and today we have Vijay Lakshman, and Vijay is the co-creator of Elder Scrolls as well. Absolutely fabulous, massive series. He joined Bethesda Softworks and has also worked on some great titles that we know, like Crash and Spyro as well. So an interesting career there. How are you doing, Vijay?
I'm doing well. Yeah, you know, what's interesting is I think I've done now 85 titles, you know, in terms of my career over the last 35 years.
Well, we've got to try and fit it all in an hour, so let's see. We're going to start from the very beginning. And what's your first kind of big gaming experience that you remember, like the first time you played a game, a computer game, or interacted with a computer?
I started in doing computer games when I was about 13 or 14 years old with my next door neighbor and, you know, eventually one of my best friends in life. A kid named Alex, and Alex had a bunch of computers that we'd go over there and play a bunch of games. And one of the ones we played all the time was Wizardry. It was done by Rob Sertek and Sertek Software. And we did Wizardry. We played Knight of Diamonds. We played a bunch of different things that were based on that, the RPG side of things. And then we got obviously into Dungeons and Dragons. We played that all the time. And it was essentially just, we'd spend the entire summer inside playing role-playing games. And my mom would just be yelling at me all the time, like, why don't you get outside? You should be running around. You're never going to get to blah, blah, blah. And I would always be a little bit like, Mom. And we got out of that, it never occurred to me that someone makes these games. And so eventually I was working at the Department of Energy. A woman took me. I'd just gotten assigned to the unit that would be getting my CNI, the Certified Network Engineer. And I was just doing this job between undergrad and med school. I'd been accepted and I was about to go. So I just wanted to earn some money so I didn't have to work during the school year. And they took me like 15 levels down in this tiny room that was a server room. And that room was like freezing. And it was one chair and one desk and 15 like giant servers, right? And so I was sitting there and the phone rang. And I pick it up and the lead programmer at Bethesda was on there. And I don't know how he... I don't know how that worked. Like they must have transferred him to me or something, but he knew where, I mean, I guess he knew my phone. I don't know how he did it, but anyways, he said, hey, look, we're looking for someone to come in and you've sent a resume in. And I said, I did send a resume in, but I sent it in a year ago. And he goes, well, I finally got to it. We do need someone. Do you know anything about, production? And I said, well, I applied to be a designer. And he said, well, we don't need a designer. We need a producer. Do you know what a producer does? And I was like, I absolutely do. I had no idea. And I ran to the interview. I left that room. I swear, I think the people at the that place, they must think I still work there because I never talked to anybody. I don't know if they're just sending checks down there. Like it was in the bowels of this building. Anyways, I ended up talking to Julian and got the job. And then I got to call my mom. And the punchline is, I said, Mom, I did get a job because of D&D. So
It all worked out in the end.
I was kind of wondering, did you then have any like formal training on the computer? Did you study computing at all before you got that job? Yeah.
Yeah. Undergrad, I had a degree in computer science and a degree in English creative writing. And so English literature. And so I ended up really, really focusing in on the creative writing stuff. But the reason why I got the job at Bethesda was they had just secured the license to a game called Traveller. And Traveller is a role-playing game. And Julian was complaining that no one knew the rule sets to Traveller. They didn't know anything. It just so happened that I have a really good memory of things I read. And I knew, like, by page number, where different rules, because I knew Traveller really well. I played it that whole summer prior. And, you know, so when I started quoting him rules and he was checking it in the Traveller handbook, you know, and I was right, he was like, dude, we have to have you for this job.
What was the company like then back then as well? The kind of size of it and what was the culture like?
It was awesome. I mean, look, I don't know. I had nothing to compare it to at the time, right? I had just my first job out. And it was probably, I would say, 12 people, of which six were in production. And all the rest were, it was like Chris Weaver, Constance Kachowski, all back office and leadership, right? They had some marketing people, a couple of interns. And then the team that actually did the development, we were in a townhouse outside of Bethesda Softworks. And we worked in this like 6-room townhouse where there was an upstairs place, you know, for me and Julian and one other guy. And then downstairs, the basement, were two more programmers that did all the ports to like the Amiga and to the other things. And that time they were doing Sword of Sodan and they were doing Wayne Gretzky hockey and also Earl Weaver baseball, I think. I'm not sure. No, so it was really neat, really small, really fun. I got the chance to work on every aspect of development from the blue sky conversations to the like planning and then scheduling, then to the creating the gold master. So then going to like alpha, beta, gold master, and then going down into the warehouse and helping with shipping and packing, literally shrink wrapping boxes. Bethesda's literally like doing everything from start to finish. So I got a really good education on how to go about making a game through the entire pipeline.
We mentioned then about those different platforms, you know, PC, Mac, Amiga was big at that time as well. And what was it like developing for multiple systems then? And was that the primary focus, making sure that they're, you know, obviously the quality control, they've got to be as good as each platform will allow? What was that kind of like?
I don't think Bethesda was really focused on quality control. I think they were really focused on staying in business. Right. I mean, every dollar counted at that time. You know, people were needed to be paid. And my hats go off to Chris Weaver and Constance for doing a great job and keeping the company afloat. They did a lot of wheeling and dealing. When I joined Bethesda, the head of marketing was a guy named Chris Mate. Chris was from MicroProse and he knew his stuff too. So we had a couple of people at the top that knew the business and the industry. And then the rest of us, essentially, we're learning and doing whatever job needed to get done. I think that's really the way to put it. Oh, in terms of the ports, so back in that day, like the main team, like if there were 8 people in production, if you count me as a producer and there's probably a assistant, the programmers were the main core, 6 of them, right? Mm-hmm. or 6 of them. So like Julian and the like 3 programmers would handle all the mainline stuff that was happening like for the main SKU. And then Randy and another guy, I can't remember his name now, but they would do like the Amiga port or something else. They just get the thing, you know, they would do the ports. So it was a pretty smooth sailing operation unless you pull boneheaded moves like I did. Like one time I sent for Terminator, I sent discs 1, 2, 3. We had 7 discs, floppy disks on 5 1/4 inch floppy disks. I sent to Star Pack for duplication, 1, 2, 3, 3, 5, 6, 7. I didn't put this 4 in. They copied 98,000 copies of it. I thought I was going to get fired. In fact, one of the guys, one of the programmers, Randy, was like, fire him. He's the producer. That's why I didn't like it. But Chris laughed and said, look, we're going to, you know, we'll figure this out. He's a learning mistake. He'll never make that mistake again. I never have.
Well, you mentioned Terminator there, and that's an absolutely huge franchise as well. What was it like when you guys kind of got Terminator, but also obviously what was the research like and kind of, you know, creating the game concept?
I will tell you, the reason I'm not a doctor today is because of that license. Because I had finished my first game for the summer, had been NCAA Road to the Final Four. And I had calculated in my head that I needed X dollars before the school started, like a job that paid X dollars, right? And what Bethesda offered me was a slightly higher than that amount. And so I went into Chris Weaver and I said, look, I'll take X dollars, which is a reduction in the salary, because I don't need all that, because I didn't plan on staying. I said, but, and I did this purely because I just wanted something to brag about at school. I said, I want my title to be executive producer. And so he said, sure, great. Here, like, you know, and I think it was like that salary then, it was 22,000, 23,000 or something. And I accepted like 20, right, to do that. But because my title was executive producer on the first game I did, and then when we started doing, it did reasonably well. Terminator came in, and now I was executive producer on Terminator. And by the end of Terminator, I was supposed to go back to school. But Terminator did really well. It did 98 in PC Gamer, and it was a runner-up or maybe even got Game of the Year. So I got all these accolades as the executive producer, and just, you know, like, stuff just started blowing my way. And I was like, well, I'm not going to go to med school during this. So I started calling and deferring my enrollment every year. And then finally, my sister, who was two and a half years behind me, she got accepted to med school. We waited till then to tell my dad that I was not actually going to, I was not actually in med school. He thought I had gone. And
right.
One of those nights when she's like, you know, you are no longer my favorite. You are my favorite.
Well, after that, I mean, the Terminator 2029, which yep. in 1992 felt a million years away, now feels scarily close, was a very good game sure. as well. I mean, you know, first-person shooter. Tell us a bit about the design of that game then, and how did you make it stand out compared to other console titles that were around at the time?
If we're talking about the first-person shooter with the WASD controlling, right, and had single-press 90-degree turns, it was just precursoring before Doom came out. And so I had been tasked with doing this, so I started reading Dark Horse Comics' Terminator series. And they did a bunch of Terminator, and they did Aliens versus Predator, and they did a bunch of different crossover-type stuff. So, and I was a huge fan of the movie, so I'd watched it dozens and dozens of times. I knew some of the lines by heart. And so I designed this whole world where I said, well, what would happen if, like, they had found that time portal thing? And then at first, you don't get to jump to time jumping. That's the big jump, right? You have some intermediate things that happen, right? Maybe robotics that they found were adaptable to human beings and things like that. So I designed this idea that there could be an exoskeleton suit that they found that could have been intended to act like a Borg, like they would just lomp onto you and then make a human into a Terminator. But by deactivating that part of it, you could still use the suit. And so they had this prototype suit. We armed I think it was John Connor actually we armed with it, but it might have been one of his men. And we had them go through, and as you sort of unlock stuff, you get more weapons, you get to upgrade the suit and things like that. And what's interesting really is, fast forward about 3 years, the next I did Terra Nova Strike Force Centauri Looking Glass. And those two games are incredibly similar. And I had not designed anything in Chernobyl, Strike Force Centauri. I came there as the producer of it, but they had all the same systems, everything. The only difference was it was a smooth scrolling 3D engine. That's pretty funny and cool, because it was pure circumstance that happened that way. But luckily I came into a project where I could give them some advice on how things would work better and not. And the other thing that's neat is the first CES I went to, because at that time games were in CES, I met Jay Wilbur and the guys over at Doom at the what was the name of their studio again?
I don't
know. Id. Yeah. So I met the guys at Id, and they were showing off Doom, and we were showing off Terminator, and we had them side by side, at one moment, and I was like, holy moly, that's so cool. I thought Doom was so cool, right? And I know that really inspired our lead programmer Julian to really dive into building our own 3D engine. So, you know, look, I mean, it's great when great games can inspire all of us to be better. And I really do actually love the guys at Id for kicking us in the pants a little bit. You know, it's nice.
I think it's really interesting that you did some kind of world building and writing about something and expanding it as well. Were you doing any writing at the side at the time, or reading a lot of novels as well?
I was. I've read 2,000 or 3,000 books, science fiction, fantasy books. I have a whole series of books that are now out of four books in this series that I've written.
Yeah, Mythborn. Yeah,
and I'm working on the fifth right now. At that time, I was actually Julian and I, this is what led up to Elder Scrolls, but Julian and I would often get lunch and then we go outside in front of Bethesda and we just sit at this tree they had up there and talk about game design. And I had asked him, hey, have you ever seen a movie called Blood of Heroes? And Julian knew it by heart. He's like, oh, yeah, I know how old I know all the multiplayer. He sounds a lot like the Terminator, Julian. He's from Denmark, 6'5". And yeah. So I don't do his accent well, but you get the idea. And Rutger Hauer, so if you don't know what Blood of Heroes is, it's a story about two teams. They have three gladiators in the front and then a runner in the back. The runner is lightly armed and armored. The gladiators are heavily armed. And the runner's job is to take a dog skull in this arena, take a dog skull and run up there and put the dog skull on the other side's spike, right? So like basketball, right? You want to go put the ball in the hoop, right? Well, this one, dog skull on a spike. And the blockers on their side are supposed to kill runner, and the blockers on this side are supposed to defend the runner. And then it reverses. And each round is how long it takes a kid to throw 100 stones at a plate. Like, so when he's done throwing the stone to the plate, the round ends and you take your dead off the field, you replace them with some people and blah, blah. And then, you know, you keep going. Well, that's what Arena was meant to be. That would have been probably one of the first MOBAs ever made. You know, if you think about it, because we had these gladiatorial teams were going to fight in an arena. The arena is going to have like obstacles. You had paths you had to follow. You could go up and do stuff. We were way ahead of the MOBA game with a game like that. We just couldn't finish in time to get that part of the game working. We spent a lot of time on the fractal-based expansive worlds. We have enough space to go travel and find new gladiators. And so in the last 2 months of the project, I had to come up with an entire story and everything to weave it to a world. So I wrote the whole stuff on Tamriel and the legends and all that stuff at the time. And I think in the end of all the writing, I think I'd done probably 5 novels worth of writing, a good 500,000 words, I would say.
And how did you kind of, you know, edit that and decide what was going to go on the cutting floor? And, you know, did you have a kind of consensus from the group and them all decide, right, we're going to go with this? Because, you know, that's quite a lot of will to kind of break down and, you know, define.
It is. I mean, I had the benefit of having spent my entire youth playing games and reading science fiction and fantasy. Also, I had the benefit of a team of which only myself and Julian and Ted, who we had hired to help with the writing, Ted Peterson, who's now working at the WayForward, Wayward Games, so Wayward Realms. Julian and I were the only ones who actually had any background in fantasy and like that kind of stuff. So it was really the mainly me and Julian and Ted. I mean, everyone contributed. So it was a nice way to like come up with something. But there was never, I can think of a time where we were like diametrically opposed to each other in terms of like what someone wanted to do and what we had done. We all sort of knew what fantasy should do. And we weren't trying to like, you know, create a new cloth out of anything. So it was a pretty harmonious kind of development process.
Well, Elder Scrolls Arena was a bit of an epic undertaking. And what do you remember about the design process of that? And I imagine your D&D background helped there.
Yeah, it did. And in fact, when you look at Elder Scrolls, that game was made with 1, 2, 3, 4, I would say 7, maybe 8 people. Just not heard of at this day and age, a game of, you know, that level. Right now, Morrowind itself and the rest of these that they've done, Elder Scrolls, I mean, they have hundreds of people on the team and they're all broken into almost like a movie like set. When I did Lord of the Rings Online at Turbine, I had, I would say, 150 developers working on, you know, different teams and doing stuff. So the world has changed. At that time, one designer, one voice, a programmer who could veto you anytime he wanted because he's also, you know, way, way above you and knew more than you did. And he didn't have to show you the code until it was out. So you really didn't have much power as you thought. And, you know, and so we got along just fine because I trusted Julian to do the right thing. And he was smart enough in terms of like the things he had read and so that he deferred a lot to the things he knew he didn't know. Like he didn't like commercialization of products. That's so interesting because that's all games are commercialization of a product and monetization loops. He didn't want to do any of that, right? So he knew that wasn't his lane, so he wouldn't get in it, which is really interesting, you know?
it was really interesting as well that they had a procedural generation implemented into the game. And do you think that really added to the like longevity of it and, you know, why it kind of became so popular?
Well, okay, so you knowing only what the public only knowing what they know, they would be right if they said it's not useful. Why did you do that? You could have saved months not doing that. But internally, when we were building it, I had a vision of duplicating the TSR concept of modules. So in D&D, you have the base rule book and all those things. And then every week or month, new adventures would come out, like Lair of the Storm Giants or, you know, the Morn Ravenloft or something like that. And like, you'd go buy that thing, you'd go home, and then you'd make the characters for that adventure, and then you'd all play that adventure, that chapter, right? So my goal was to have Elder Scrolls, that world, Tamriel, take all the content I'd made, and then those would be modules that we'd build. So the next one in the series was going to be Mournhold, which is the equivalent of Ravenloft. And then we had another one that had to do with giants, and we had another one that had to do with a lot of different areas. Werewolves, I remember, was one. Vampires was one. And so when we decided to do that, we realized that we needed to build a world that if you wanted to, you could go buy the module, you go and play it. And then when you're done, you could reseed the world. It would repopulate the world, change the map a little bit, and leave you more adventure to do because you could replay each level and you could play it and change the difficulty of the remapping of the world so that you could have more monster areas in some areas, things like that. But when we ran out of time and realized Elder Scrolls Arena was made in 13 months. So that's nothing from development. I mean, it's almost half the time that it takes now to make a AAA RPG. So now it takes 26 months. So, and we were told to convert our arena based gladiatorial fighting game, at month 9. So from we had 9, 10, and 11. To change it because 12 and 13 were testing, right? And so it was a lot of late nights.
was it tough to get that balance correct? You know, with different abilities, but also having that procedural generation, making sure it didn't go out of skew too much.
I can't say that we had the bandwidth to test all the different permutations of what the world could be, but we were less concerned with that. What I decided to do when I realized we didn't have time to do a full testing of the system was to create the spellmaker and the other one for the weapons maker, right? The weapon maker and spellmaker. That I know now games do a lot of that, but in better, I think better ways. But at the time, no one on none of the Ultima series, none of the stuff that we were sort of competing against at the time had ever come up with the ability to create customized spells that did a certain amount of damage, had special effect, that all tied it together into a thing. So Julian and I designed that. I did that so that if there was an error in the way in which we'd balance things, they could use the spellmaker to fix it. They could go, oh, that spell is not weak, strong enough. I could up the power a little bit, right? And that way it gave the players a little bit of agency over some of our potentially dumb decisions. Just not enough time to do what you had to do. So I didn't want the players to be stuck because of our mistake, you know? And that actually turned out to be a cool feature. So
What was it like working with Ted Peterson as well? Because Ted ended up, you know, working on a lot of the series and
yes.
and really far to the kind of Morrowind stuff later on. You know, he's doing a lot of quest design as well. And what was it like with Ted?
He's awesome. He was great. I mean, I loved it. He, you know, we made every person who came in to get that job to work, you know, alongside me on the design. We had them doing stories. We'd have them write a story, a short story, and then we'd read it and see if it was entertaining or not, right? And I recall that Ted wrote something that was really quite hysterically funny. And you know, he went on to work on The Simpsons, the Any River software, and on that, because like he's an excellent, incredible writer. So I was very thankful to have him because I can do writing, but I can also do statistics and math because of my comp sci background. And Ted didn't have the comp sci side, but he had a better writing side. And so we sort of divvied the work up and were able to accomplish a lot because we just, you know, worked to our strengths. So I thought it was awesome. I think it was great. Great. Still funny guy. Great guy.
Well, when Elder Scrolls Arena came out, I mean, 1994, that was quite a competitive time for RPG games. You mentioned Ultima, that was still going strong. Yep, Wizardry 7, I think, yep. was that around then, a couple of years earlier. Yep. Might and Magic was still going. Betrayal at Krondor. I mean, how did you kind of make sure that the game stood out compared to the other RPGs that were on the market at the time and had a difference?
Yeah, I would look at the time zone map for what time it was everywhere in the world. And then because I would go to all these conferences, I had the business card of anyone who was like a lead on those games. And I would call them at 3 a.m. and then I'd hang up. That way I knew they'd get not good sleep and nice. We'd be better. I'm kidding. That would be funny if I did that.
That's a good tactic though, yeah.
No. I think that the thing is that it's not like, the truth is, when there's a ton of competition out there, that competition is really only mitigated, or I'm sorry, only limited by the amount of marketing dollars you have to keep the game in front of people. Because given all no constraints, every player would play every RPG that was launched that year. Like they would just play them all. Like there wasn't like they only had no space for this many RPGs. So in the end, like if you had a good game, and we did, and if you had like good ideas and a good world and it had a good basis and the team cared, you would have people who would put you in the queue of things they wanted to play, and then they would play them. So what was nice was we could justify extending our marketing spend because the game kept selling, right? And that made a lot of sense. But I know that people have had a situation where they can't necessarily do that anymore because budgets are limited, and now you're spending not tens of thousands, but tens of millions. So very, very different world in which they're doing marketing.
What's it kind of like looking back at that world, you know, when you've got Elder Scrolls like coming out now and quite a modern fan base for it as well, and the series still continuing when other series has kind of dropped off?
I can take credit for the thing I did do, which was build that world and the world lore. But in all honesty, Ted and the people that came after me, you know, at that time, Todd Howard was an intern, and you know, he used to work alongside us too. Those guys, they get the credit for what they took, you know, my original book and they what they made with it, which was, you know, awesome, huge.
Kind of so, molded it and refined it. And yeah.
And they got the, you know, I love that they put the right people on, that they got the right people, that they were able to spend that money and do the right thing. You know, I mean, my hats go off to Bethesda and, you know, Lotko and all the people who are in management there and Robert Altman, you know, and all that stuff that happened. And you know, I mean, they're the testament to their strength and to the strength of the story I built is that they got bought by Microsoft for $9.7 billion, mm-hmm. something. So it's crazy. That's, you know, amazing. Yeah, I'm very proud of that.
Well, you worked on some other huge projects at Bethesda as well. Wayne Gretzky Hockey was another title that you worked on. And you ended up at Vivendi Universal. So what was the story with you leaving Bethesda and ending up at Vivendi then? What happened?
My value kept going up. But I mean, by the time... I'd been at Bethesda for 5 years when I left. And by that time, my dad is a doctor. I was making more than him, considerably more. And so, and the offers were piling up. And I was like, I want to go try something else. I had never intended to be at Bethesda my whole life. In fact, I intended to be in med school long before that, right? So, you know, so when I left, I took a job, where was it? At Magnet Interactive in DC. But then from there, I moved into my dream job, which was working for Looking Glass, the creators of Ultima Underworld, and like, you know, all the things they had done. They'd done that flying thing, Flight Unlimited. And so I was psyched, and they were working on Thief, the Dark Project, which, you know, the time was called Dark Camelot, then became Thief. And I was head of RPG, executive producer for the RPG side. So I got a chance to work on some really huge titles there. Awesome. You know, I loved it.
Well, one kind of huge title and one huge mascot at the time was Crash Bandicoot. And, you know, PlayStation was so desperate to have a kind of mascot and Crash kind of became the default. Yeah. What was it like working with that mascot, but also, you know, approaching it for Crash Bash and, you know, not messing it up, basically, with him.
My job, I cannot take credit for the design because my job was to keep the ship on the rails, right? I mean, I'm sorry, the train on the rails, right? Mixing analogies now. But the greatest thing that happened was I got to meet Mark Cerny. And Mark Cerny and I traveled through Europe. We went to Traveler's Tales in Manchester, and we ended up talking to the guys there and, you know, working on Crash, but also Crash Team Racing. And, you know, we had a lot of fun. And Mark, in that week or so that we traveled together, I learned more about game design and production and prioritization. And so it was like I got to go to a finishing school. It was great, you know, and and Mark is a great guy. He's funny, very programmer like funny. Like he has funny jokes that you don't get until 2 or 3 minutes later when you realize what he actually was saying, that kind of stuff, you know. A lot of fun guys. So I loved it. And, you know, and I was good at keeping the train on the tracks. I mean, I was good at like understanding how the finance goes. I had been training my entire life in martial arts, so I was very accustomed to being in a leadership role. You know, training students is no different than training kids who are, you know, trying to code something that day and get it done, or, you know, whatever other task they had to get done. And I kept sort of like people focused on the goal, which was, you know, to have a productive day. That's something that I sort of became an expert at. So,
yeah, Rev, you mentioned Crash Bash as well. I mean, that was a really fun concept. Did you think there was a gap in the market for that kind of competitive gameplay for PlayStation fans?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually Mark and I think it was Daniel Suarez. It might have been also Ricky Riccovina, but the guys, the producers who worked for me alongside Mark, they'd been doing a lot of brainstorming and throwing things back and forth, and so did the developer. The developer had come up with a bunch of things. Traveler's Tales had a bunch of ideas, and you know, we also got a chance to work with Insomniac Studios on Spyro. So, you know, Ted Princeton, all those guys, they were great guys, right? And you learn from these giants of that day. Now they're, you know, Hall of Famer type people, right? And so I thought it was great that, like, at that time, and this is something I really love about the games industry, there's always going to be a little bit of competitive, like, I don't want you to see what I'm doing kind of thing. But in general, everyone wants everyone else in their position to win. So, you know, like, we sit around, we don't come up with ways to, like, shackle the game or to shackle a person to a loser. We're pretty quick at coming in and going, hey, that is never going to work. I've done it this. It's not going to work. Do it this way instead, you know? That kind of stuff is really great. I like that kind of camaraderie that comes there.
Well, it's interesting because we're in a world where we can kind of add Bluetooth controllers and pair them quickly. Back then, you know, you needed a multi-tap for controller support. I wonder, was that anything you guys ever discussed and kind of considered, because it might have limited it slightly, you know, with the amount of players that you get on?
My one failing as a producer, I think, is that I'm very blue sky in general. And, you know, typically you find a producer is nuts and bolts and really down there, like putting things in. But as a blue sky person, I could talk to the team and say, hey, do you guys ever think of this or think of that? And 9 times out of 10, it would go nowhere. But, like, you know, they would basically tell me, shut up. We're never going to get done if we listen to you. But like 1 out of 10, you get a game where I suggest something and it becomes monster play in Lord of the Rings, where you can jump in the body of a monster in the PvP zone and have legal PvP with players who don't normally do PvP, because now it's a monster controlled by a human against the player. And the player gets better yeeps, better equipment, better drops, all that. Those kinds of ideas, I'm happy that if they're only 1 out of 10, great. It's still a great idea to go in and get into the thing. So I didn't stop what I was doing. But you are right about one thing. The amount of, like, the amount of technical limitations I think of that we don't have to think about anymore, it's unbelievable. I mean, I used to, you know, feel like I was poking myself in the eye because I love working with drones. Have you ever flown drones? Yeah. So in the early days of flying drones, it was a lot of the early days of doing games. Like, if you didn't have something jury-rigged, all kinds of places to make it work, you know, how do you get it done? And now they have goggles that connect to the thing connect, like, you see, like, you're flying in the drone. I mean, yeah, I'm jealous of them. I'm jealous of the East, but I learned a lot, you know?
Well, you did mention Spyro the Dragon, which was released in 1998. And I know Insomniac before that had made an FPS game called Disruptor, which got a lot of praise, but actually sold pretty poorly. And obviously Spyro is a completely different game. I mean, do you remember when you first heard about Spyro the Dragon and heard the concept, and what did you think of it?
The honest truth is, when I got to Universal, I saw the Spyro, the producer in charge of Spyro at the time was a guy named Ricky. And Ricky is an insanely talented designer and producer. And but he, like me, is very blue sky. So, like, you know, he's thinking and thinking all the time. And Spyro, I have to admit, I am not a big platform game player. You know, the idea of trying to jump from one platform to another and nail it is not my idea of a fun game. But I love the dragon. I just love the way the dragon looked, the way it moved, the stuff it did. It was very compelling. So I knew right away they were going to have a secondary mascot, or at least a equivalent mascot to Crash, right? And they did. I'm just surprised they didn't do a duo team between the two, you know, working together. Or maybe they did, but I never saw it. You know, but I thought it was brilliant. And Ricky embodied Spyro. He knew everything of every game that we'd done. You know, he's a very, very talented guy. So I love that, you know, he was able to keep Insomniac engaged. And after them, we had other studios working on it. You know, he did a great job of keeping them all sort of on track.
It was kind of a unique challenge because you had the GameCube and the PS2 development kind of going on at the same time. What was it like, you know, having that balance and also with Nintendo and their whole kind of approval process as well compared to the PlayStation?
In terms of brand management and licensing, we had very adept people dealing with that. I had to deal with it with the Tolkien estate on Lord of the Rings. We had to do with Crash Bandicoot. We had to do it with Sony and Spyro. There was a lot of but the cool thing was our boss, Jim Wilson, who is insanely talented. The guy's I learned so much from him. You know, I worked my longest time was at Universal. I was there for 10 years, which is 50 years in dog years, right? I mean, it's like, you know, you're there. You can get, most people get burned out very quickly at a studio because there's so much going on. Jim's had incredible foresight, and he made it very important for us to have great relationships with our counterparts at Sony, at Microsoft, at, you know, wherever, right? And, as a result, our producers were on a first name basis with their producers. We talk all the time. And so it was actually less difficult than you would think to manage all that. The hard part was the approvals process. You had to have a good relationship with your third party approval team because they're going to take it through Nintendo's lot checks and there are different tests there. And Sony's going to do its test and, you know, Nintendo's going to do their time. I mean, Microsoft. I sort of emulated Jim and had my producers always know who their third party rep was, take them out. You know, luckily in LA, a lot of these guys are, you know, not that far away. You can go just get together with them. And so I made it mandatory that they did. They, you know, take them to lunch and talk to them, tell them that, you know, what you're trying to do and have a relationship with them because they're not terrible people. They just don't like to be surprised, you know.
Well, one thing, thinking of Spyro the Dragon, I think it was Spyro 3 that had a pretty legendary anti-piracy system in there where if it was a copied version of the game, it would gradually get slower and slower. And I remember watching, I think it was a Twitch streamer who was trying to do a 100% playthrough of the pirated version of Spyro 3, and it kept getting slower, and it took him about 9 hours, I think, and he still didn't do it in the end. Do you remember much about that, and was piracy a big problem on the PlayStation?
So you have to remember there's three parties in every one of those games. The parties are Sony as the IP holder, Universal as the publisher, and the developer as the developer. And so a lot of times when things would happen that were technical, it would be up to us to figure out what the answer should be and the developer to implement it. Or it would be Sony saying we're being infringed upon. And then they would go to the developer and have something fixed. In the particular case of this, as I recall, Mark Cerny was very much involved in the whole process. So I didn't have to be very upfront and center in that. And I suspect that if it's slowing the game down, it sounds very much like the kind of code Mark would write, you know, the kind of solution you'd come up with because he's a genius, but also has a quirky sense of humor. So I can't say for sure that he did it, but I would attribute it to him. You know, if someone had, you know, put a gun to my head, I'd say, you know, he probably put that in.
Did that. It's a good idea, though, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's a great idea. You know,
well, you ended up moving to Warner Bros. Turbine Entertainment as well. What was it like moving there with that kind of movie connection as well and, you know, the licensing that they had?
It's amazing to go from a movie studio company, and I actually negotiated with Tolkien Estate to buy back all the rights. Universal had World of Warcraft, and they wanted to like pursue. They had two MMOs going on at that time. I was working on Lord of the Rings Online, Shadows of Angmar, and Lord of the Rings Online and World of Warcraft were taking up a lot of the budget, right, that Universal would have. They're both big projects. And so I had gone to Universal and said, look, if I can negotiate Tolkien Estate, because there's a $7 million licensing fee coming up. And I said, if I can negotiate and I pay it out of, you know, our side, can I take the license and I'll go to Turbine? And we had talked the whole thing through and they gave me the blessing to do it, pending that I could get Tolkien Estate to agree. I went to Tolkien, talked to them about it, convinced them it'd be better for them because they would no longer have a Universal third party in there. It would just be straight to Turbine. Basically, nothing would change for them. It'd be me. They'd still be talking to me, but it would be now at Turbine. And so then I left with the license and all the rights to Turbine. And, you know, obviously, Jeff at Turbine, the brilliant attorney, he basically sort of concocted how this could all work the right way. And when you needed to, you'd step in and, nudge. And it went really, really well. And the biggest change for me was going from a place where, it's natural, but like I came up as an internal development studio. The Softworks, Looking Glass, Magnet, all those were internal studios. Then I went to, Bootprint, which was in Texas. Mm. Then I went to, and FASA in Chicago, right? These are all internal studios, not publishers. And so I had a lot of background in doing internal publishing. Then I went to Universal. Universal is, they're an external publisher in the sense that all my producers, they were captains of external developers, right? So they would come in and they would basically be the equivalent of the CEO to the CEO. Right, they're that level with the CEO of that company, and I was above them, so I would only get involved if they needed someone to push hard in some direction. Yeah,
I guess the difference as well was that it was an online MMO as well, compared to previous RPGs, and also there was a lot of rivalry out at the time from other MMOs. How did you help kind of define Lord of the Rings?
I think the people outside thought of it as a rivalry, but you got to remember that Mike Morheim over at World of Warcraft and I were already friends. I still talk to him today. And then, Chris Dill, who was my CTO at Turbine and became the CTO for Unreal, he actually was a groomsman in my wedding at the time. So, we all are close. The community is close, regardless of what the companies might posture themselves as. So we never really had, a fight. What we tried to do as best we could was not launch right over someone else's launch, right? There's just be dumb. You're not going to win even if you're better or lose because you're losing people to the other guy no matter what you are, you know?
And there were so many kind of in the works as well and hyped. I remember Warhammer was another one that people were talking about that was going to come out. Was the free to play model really important? And was it hard to convince people? That they needed to go free to play.
Yeah, I mean, Turbine, we pioneered it there. I give the credit to Jeff. If you look at the player habits, right, what they're doing, his impassioned plea was that, look, they're spending to the players, to the community was, look, you're spending $10 a month no matter what. But what happens if instead you can take that $10 and you get a sword and armor and things for your character, right? Like you can choose if you want to buy new gear that month or not. You can choose if you want to instead keep that. You can choose if you want, whatever you want to do, right? So in a way, he put the power of the dollar back into the community's hands, the player's community hands. Now, the brilliance of that is when people are left alone to spend what they want, they're spending way more than $10 a month, way, way more, right? Our per user contribution margin was up in the near $20. It was quite a bit different. And so I thought I learned a great lesson there in my career was, when you have a choice and the outcome won't matter in the sense that like the gameplay isn't going to change, give the choice to the player because they're going to be more feeling more like they have agency over there, over what happens in the world, and they're more likely to support you because they take a responsibility for the choices they made. If we give it to them. So I think it's a huge lesson.
I think, you know, that's pretty standard now, free to play. And amazing to think that it kind of wasn't for a while and that, you know, it was a risk to actually go out and do that.
Yeah. And I love that I was part of the team that we pioneered that. And I think that's a huge feather in Turbine's cap.
Also, another thing is when you do launch these massive online experiences, we know with some of the most famous games in the world, there's been huge crashes with demands of users and stuff. How did you kind of cope with the technical, pylon of people coming onto the servers and launching it?
I think the mentality, watching EverQuest come out, and, you know, a very good friend of mine, Richard Bogle, who was a producer for me at Magnet, he, I think, is in head of the, or at least for a while, was the head of the EverQuest franchise. You know, we watched many other of our brothers come out and, like, maybe stumble at the gates. And so what we realized was you can't think of launching an MMO the way you think of launching a single-player game. Single-player games are like movie debuts, right? They're like opening day at the movie box office. You want to pack the seats. Everyone wants to buy one, you know, be part of that experience. MMOs are like episodic content, right? Like when a new series is going to start, it's not so important that you're there for the pilot as long as the pilot is shown again and again and again, because you have people, stragglers, who didn't get to see the pilot when it debuted, but it doesn't matter because it's a whole season of things coming up, like Game of Thrones, for example. You know, they launched the new version of episode of Game of Thrones on a Sunday, I think, afternoon, evening. But they would do it again on Monday, and they do it again Sunday night at midnight. They do it on Monday, on Wednesday. And, you know, I mean, they let you catch up with the thing. And so in that sense, by the time we were ready to launch our games, we really started thinking about it in terms of a couple of things. One, our launches were soft launches in the sense that we didn't promise that the game wouldn't get updated day one launch, you know, day one updates. And number two, we made day one updates sound more like a benefit than a fix. Mm. In the sense we said, hey, you know, we're committed to you guys. Not only are we launching the game, we're also doing day one. So you're going to get even more stuff as you go in. And then the third thing is we stopped testing locally in the US. We started testing a game in Canada and in like places like that where they're still English speaking. But if they had a terrible outcry of something they didn't like, their damage to our launch would be limited, right? So we had certain areas we'd go to, including, you know, like you find in the Philippines and Canada and Britain. You had to be very careful how you did it. But by isolating communities that can give you feedback, even if they give you no feedback voluntarily, they do it by grousing, we could take that, fix it, and then we launch the main launch in the main world. And so we always had a plan of this concept of a live team. And the live team was essentially the development team would hand over the launch to the live team. The live team had a bunch of game masters and people like that, but they also had a bunch of tools and a very special protocol to elevate things that were crash bugs in the beginning to up to the back to the main team. And then that live team was the one that would continue to propagate the product, but also go on to continue to support it, gather what's priority, and then fix those products, and be very communicative through a community manager with the community, so people knew that, you know, we were on it. I think that's just how you handle, you know, a subscription based product of any kind. You know,
well, in 2006, Turbine, and it's kind of going back to roots for you, Dungeons and Dragons Online. First released, and obviously a very well-loved franchise, a lot of lore around it as well. What were some of the challenges of bringing such a legendary franchise to the MMO world? What memories have you got of that?
Strangely, when I did Elder Scrolls at Bethesda, we hired a couple people shortly after, I think just maybe in the middle of Elder Scrolls. One was Ken Ralston and another guy, Jeb. And these guys were... people worked at, like Ken worked at West End Games. I remember he worked on a game called Paranoia and some other stuff. These are pencil and paper games. And, Jeb, I want to say his last name is Stuart, but I got to look it up. Jeb worked on, he was at with Gary Gygax working on, D&D. And so, it's just funny that full circle now. I'm working on D&D, but you know, those guys. That it was awesome. I mean, how can you not? If you're a gamer and you love games, and if you came up playing role playing games, and now you're working on D&D, the father, I think, of role playing games. It's hard not to say to yourself, man, I'm so happy right now, you know? You know, and I think that, the right developer got it. Turbine did a great job. The game did fine. And, I think that, you know, it pioneered a lot of new things like the, no monthly fee, and just, pay, like you can buy merchandise for your character and that would make up for the, free to play. They pioneered free to play that concept. And, you know, I was lucky to be where I was at the time I was, because now with Web3 games coming up and the stuff that we're working on, my company's working on now, we really are taking all these lessons I learned from before and able to apply them to this whole new medium, which is frankly, every new medium is really new. It's so new, but really it's, you know, you got to learn from your past and then apply it again. So now we're talking about, you know, what people like to call Web3 gaming, but I think we like to call it on-chain gaming. Because it's on the blockchain. So on-chain is a little less confusing. I'm excited because our company, Andromeda, .gg, and Andromeda is actually like Andromeda, but without a DA at the end, it's a TA. So Meta is at the end of the thing. It's Andromeda.gg. We're, you know, raising money and, well on our way, I think, to being a huge publisher for this space, this on-chain space.
We'll definitely go into what you're doing at the moment because you're working on some really interesting and worthwhile projects there. Just before we do that, I mean, you touched on it at the start of the interview that, you know, you've written some books. So tell us about your Mythborn novels then. What's kind of the background on those and how do people get hold of them then if they want to read them?
So you go to Amazon and type in Mythborn, M-Y-T-H-B-O-R-N, Mythborn. Everyone has seen Lord of the Rings and you know that Saruman, that scene when he's in the tower and he's looking at the orcs killing all the trees. I suddenly like asked myself one day, I was like, what does he do when that scene ends? Like, okay, he's 1,000 feet up and the last guy that went up died, right? So no one's going to go up like to bring him lunch or something. And he looks a little too old to go down 1,000 feet of stairs, then back up again. There doesn't seem to be an obvious bathroom in that room. And like, there's also no really table or chair. I mean, I imagine myself going, what does he do? Like, what happens when the camera cuts? Then does he just start yelling out, hello, I'm hungry, someone come up, you know? So the thing is, I realized that like a lot of the writing that I'd seen, and I now at this point been writing for 20 years on games, 25 years, 30 years on games, I decided to take my hand at a novel. But I knew that the novel I wanted to write would not be a novel where it had, cookie cutter heroes, right? Or like they wouldn't be black or white, like they wouldn't be good or bad, right? Like everyone, like my father told me this once when I was trying to understand why my girlfriend at the time was doing something, and he was so good with like my mom, like how he handled that relationship, that I would give him for advice, and he said, he's like, you know, Vijay, you need to remember that everybody's a hero in their own story, right? And so when you think of that, Darth Vader is a hero in his own story, right? Everyone is. Even the most vile person you can think of, they're doing something because they have a vision of a better world, but they do what they do. And the only movie I've seen capture that, frankly, is Firefly, right? Where the wonderful actor, I can't pronounce his name, but he's the agent running after them. African gentleman who like, he works with a sword. And he goes, we're monsters to these people in this world. And Mal, the leader, he says, you know, well, where's a place for you in this world like that? He goes, oh, I don't expect to live there. Like, we're not, you know, like, he's just not even made for that. I thought that was so well done. So my story, Mythborn, is about a kid who is an assassin, trained to be an assassin, and he does missions with his instructor. They're often sent out. A gate to a demon world opens up. And, his power is ability to kill magic, like to stop magic temporarily. And his master, without his knowledge, his master has been told to take him to that gate on this next mission and kill him there at the gate. I won the Bechdel Award, which is writing women with agency and purpose. You can test for Bechdel if you can take a woman character in a scene and you can replace her with a lamp. If you do that, she is not, you cannot win the Best Dill Award, right? Because a lot of women are written in as placeholders. Like they're just objects, right? And, you know, and so it doesn't make any sense to write something like that. So I wrote all the women in my book, like the women I had been raised by, which was my grandmother and my mother and my sister. And they are not pushover lamps. They'll kill you. So, you know, yeah, I learned well on it.
It sounds awesome. I'll put a link to it in the Amazon link in the show notes as well if people want to click through. Yeah, Mythborn. So, yeah, worth a look.
Also, you've been doing some great work as well around autism and Chroma Pets as well.
Yes.
I think that's a project involving it.
So I hate to date myself, but I am 57, right? And I will be, I'm 58 this year. When I was 50, I found out, to my surprise, that I am on the spectrum. It's and I'm slightly, obviously, highly functional, but I am part of what you consider to be autistic. And I know it manifests itself in a lot of different ways, but the main way you can tell is I don't like to make direct eye contact in general. That's why my father put me in martial arts, which is why Mythborn is so well written, because I had 30 years of training in martial arts before I started writing combat. And so it all leads to one thing. But so making eye contact to me was very difficult, because I would interpret people's expressions very differently than one might if they were normal. Like, you know, they didn't look nice to me. When people smiled, I thought it was like a baring of teeth. It looked very aggressive, things like that. So I've learned now in just a short 7 years, I've learned how to fix that. But had I known that when I was 10, maybe I'd probably be a doctor at this point. I wouldn't have been engaged. but I've wondered, like, you know, shouldn't kids be able to be diagnosed early? And so with these generative AI agents, we've trained agents now to know everything in the manual for mental illnesses. And so they're experts of like what's going on, and they can from the web bring down whatever the latest information is on any given area of things. And I designed them as virtual pets. These pets are customizable. They grow with the kid. And if you have a pet and you're wearing AR goggles, you can see them running around like you would, you know, the Pokemon Go. Or if you're playing in the game world, obviously you'll see them there, or in the VR world, you'll see them there. These pets are fun creatures that like hang out, but they're always on. They're sitting resident in your watch, or they're sitting resident in your phone, where, and they're listening to everything. And if they can, they're watching everything because the camera will be working. And when you run into conflict, or you run into a difficulty, or you run into a stumbling block during your day as a result of your condition, the pet finds it, classifies it, categorizes it, and then goes to the AI side of things. And it uses that to build a scenario. So when you go back to when you go back home and you want to play your pet on its island, because you're basically, it's one of those builder games where you're building the lair and you're building things. The pet will suffer the same thing you had to face that day in a slightly different context. And as the kid has to help guide the pet out of that situation by learning, like, how do you deal with things like that? So because I did the martial arts forever, we learned that the best and most effective way to teach a kid is to have him teach another kid. Right. And so, so what we do is we would like teach one kid, and then we'd have him teach two kids, and then we had those two teach four kids, and, you know, and then we would be there to correct the sloppiness that, you know, an expert doesn't yet know how to do. But that's not the point. The point was that first kid and second, third, each round, the learning was actually going backwards. It was to the person who, you know, the people who were teaching. We were less concerned about the people who were learning at the time, because they would soon be teaching also. Right. Yeah. And then they would get a chance to build their ability up. And also, when you're like six or seven, it's not like you're going to be like killing someone with your kicks and stuff. It's still in the movies. So,
it sounds a great medium to teach kids those skills, though. I think, yeah, that's really right. Clever. Yeah.
I think it breeds empathy. You know your pet's suffering. You learn about group dynamics. You're watching what's going on. You can hear what they say. It may be couched in a way that reminds you of what you had heard that day, but not exactly. It's not a recording, because it's an AI they can mimic. And by solving the problem, you'll remember it next time you face it. You know, how did you get through it? So that is called Chroma Pets. And, you know, chroma is the spectrum. I had thought of the spectrum of light. So the Chroma Pets are the spectrum of autism and whatever other things, including ADHD and other things that people suffer. The biggest thing I have to figure out right now is with FDA approvals and, that kind of stuff, it can, I don't want the 6 to 10 years it might take to get it through that system. Yeah. So, you know, we might launch it and not claim that it is going to fix a, you know, autism, but instead that it's a great confidence builder or a great, like, you know, way to learn, you know, skills that are necessary, you know, for kids. And in fact, we may not even label it as for kids on the spectrum, but for anyone who wants to learn how to, you know, manage conflict resolution and things like that. That way we don't make any claims that are medically based and we can get it out to people sooner. Yeah. I think parents would appreciate that. I don't think they're, I mean, look, the kid's not going to get better doing nothing. So
no, it sounds really, yeah, absolutely, like I said, very worthwhile. Yeah. Chroma Pet Center, people want to keep an eye out for that. Incredible work, Vijay, and best of luck with it. And
thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your history as well. It's been wonderful to chat to you, and thanks for taking the time to be our guest.
I have one comment I would give any listener that I, as a, it is my adage of life, and that is, you know, wisdom comes from experience, and experience is earned through bad judgment. And so believe me when I say I am a very wise person, because I don't think there's a mistake I have not made when it comes to my career and my life. But I am so thankful for the opportunities to have made those mistakes and to like learn from them. So, you know, be present, bring your A game. That's the way that life is. That's how you bring success. Be present, bring your A game.
Thank you, Vijay. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. We'll be right back.